Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're happy to hear oral arguments in person here today. The next case on our calendar is A21-1312, Rondell Russell Camp versus State of Minnesota. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. You should be able to see a timer on the podium over there. I believe the yellow light will flash when you have 5 minutes left. Hopefully the marshal discussed that with you. And appellant's counsel, you can proceed when you're ready. Please identify yourself and the party you represent for the recording.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Newmark. I represent appellant in this case, Rondell Camp. This is an appeal from a post-conviction decision in Hennepin County District Court denying my client's petition for post-conviction relief. The issue here is a fairly narrow one. The issue presented for the court is whether the erroneous jury instruction given by the district court affected or reasonably affected the outcome. What happened in this case is my client was accused of one count, which was an intentional second-degree murder. He requested a self-defense instruction. The district court gave a instruction which related to a justifiable taking of a life, which was contrary to the testimony of my client as well as the arguments of defense counsel, which was that the death was unintended. This court, as well as the Minnesota Supreme Court, has repeatedly stated that the proper self-defense instruction, when the argument and the testimony of the defendant is that the death was unintended, is the general self-defense instruction, not the justifiable taking of a life instruction. And that's important for a number of reasons. First and foremost, the standard is far different. On a justifiable taking of a life instruction requires that the defendant perceive fear, imminent great bodily harm or death, which is a far higher standard than the general self-defense instruction, which simply allows a person to use reasonable force under the circumstances to prevent bodily harm. So it's not a minor distinction, it's a major distinction. And again, this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have repeatedly said that the instruction given here was incorrect. There are a number of cases which address this, State v. Carradine, which is a Supreme Court case, and State v. Pollard, which is a decision by this court, which addressed this issue and came out in different ways. Essentially, the rationale in Carradine is that a jury finding of intentionality, or in this case, intentional second-degree murder, essentially renders moot or makes irrelevant the self-defense claim, because necessarily by finding the intentionality part of the elements of the offense, the self-defense instruction becomes irrelevant. This case is different than Carradine for a number of reasons, but first and foremost, the instruction given here presupposes that the murder was intentional. By giving the instruction in and of itself, which says the taking of a life by intentional means, and then goes on to give what the defense is, presupposes that the crime was intentional. In other words, the court essentially instructed the jury that this was an intentional crime, and then the jury was left with an instruction which again states a much higher standard for self-defense than the general self-defense instruction.
Mr. Newmark, just so that I'm crystal clear about your argument, it sounds like you're making sort of a twofold prejudice argument. One, it was just the wrong instruction, and so the jury didn't have appropriate guidance. But it sounds to me like your second prejudice argument is along the lines of, by just giving this instruction, the court essentially directed a verdict or something of that equivalent on the second-degree murder offense. Is that right?
In some sense, yes. And obviously, they gave the wrong instruction. I don't think anybody disputes that the instruction that was given here was the wrong one. And so that impacted the self-defense case because, as I said earlier, the jury was instructed on a much higher standard. And the second point is the point I'm also making as well, is essentially the court, I wouldn't say ordered a directed verdict, but in some ways that's a proper way to phrase it. The court essentially said that because the defense in this case is I intended the murder, but I had a legal justification, the jury could only assume that the court meant exactly what the instruction said, which was the murder was intentional. So then the jury looks at the elements of the underlying offense and says, oh, in order for the person to be guilty, they must have intended the murder. The court's already said they intended the murder. And so I think both of those reasons are wrong. In and of itself, the instruction is wrong, and it deprives my client of the true self-defense claim, which was here, which is I didn't intend the murder, and therefore the jury should look at my actions and whether they were reasonable to prevent bodily harm, not great bodily harm or death. But I do believe that the instruction in and of itself requires the jury to presuppose that the murder was intentional. And that's the danger of giving the wrong instruction. That's the exact danger of giving the wrong instruction, is that if the jury reads the instruction and they're presumed to follow the instructions, the judge has told them this murder was intentional, and then they go back to the elements, and really the contested element in this case was the murder intentional.
So how is this different from Carradine, though? I mean, I know in Carradine we were... there's a first-degree murder charge, a premeditated murder charge. Couldn't the same argument have been made in that case? And why is this case different?
Well, there are a number of differences. That's one of them, is the premeditation, which is an additional element that the jury needed to find. So in that case, the jury found premeditation and then went on to find, in my view, that it was intentional because they'd already found premeditation, so it didn't really matter what that instruction was. And also, it's not clear from the context, but it sounds like Carradine actually requested the instruction. And in this case, there wasn't a defense request of the instruction. I grant you that there was no objection made to it, but it's a different context when the defendant is requesting an instruction, because that means that he actually wanted it and intended to argue off that instruction. And then the other context is this is ineffective assistance of counsel claim, which was not the claim that was made.
But in terms of the influence, if you will, of the wrong instruction on the jury's determination of the elements of the offense, are you saying it's different or the same?
It's different because of the reasons I said, but also the facts here are different. Carradine was a shooting. This case was not a shooting. And so...
Well, as we get to the facts, I have another concern, which is... the first appeal, we did analyze the sufficiency of evidence and have already stated what circumstances have been proved. And so how do you think that that determination or that decision impacts what we do going forward, especially with regard to how the court in Pollard went on, didn't close the door based on Carradine, but went on in... So I wonder what you think about the previous appeal and what that means for whether that's still an option for us.
Right, and I appreciate the question. The analysis that was done by this court on the direct appeal was in the context of the actual instruction that was given, because there had not been an objection made and there hadn't been the issue raised on appeal. This court essentially invited a post-conviction petition, in my view, by raising that very point, which is the instruction that was given was wrong. And the court obviously couldn't do the other analysis because it wasn't before the court. That issue is now before the court. Which analysis was proper, and would the result have been different if the proper instruction had been given, and how is that analyzed? And so I think the distinction is the analysis that this court made and the analysis that the jury made was in the context of justifiable taking of a life. What I'm asking this court to do is to review it in a different context, which is the general self-defense instruction, which is the bodily harm instruction. Did my client reasonably fear bodily harm? And then were his actions reasonable and appropriate under the circumstances? And that's a question that the jury never got to decide, and that's an issue that this court didn't address on direct appeal because it wasn't before the court.
Right, but we did conclude that it's not reasonable to infer on that evidence or on those circumstances proved that there were objective grounds for Camp's actions. And we also, in listing what was proved, included the circumstance regarding a sustained attack, at some point stopping to switch weapons and continuing the attack. So it seems like there might be some parameters set or some limits on our review of the facts based on the previous decision, no?
I don't agree with that because, again, the court's review of the facts and the context of the review was under the wrong jury instruction, which was the exact same context and analysis that the jury made. And so I don't believe this court made the analysis.
I mean, there's still a duty to retreat under the justifiable taking of a life as well as the general, right?
Right, but we don't know what the jury found or, you know, if and how they rejected. Well,
we know that this court has said one of the circumstances proved was the sustained and continued nature of the attack. So it seems like that might be inconsistent with going on as to then review under, I guess, the second Strickland prong, whether there's any prejudice, because if the other elements of a general self-defense defense could not have been established based on what we've already said were the circumstances proved and what reasonable inferences there may or may not have been. So I wonder how that determination is does not limit to some degree our analysis on the second Strickland prong today.
Well, when this court went through that analysis, it was based on a jury verdict, and of course the standard when you're looking at a sufficiency of the evidence claim or a similar claim is, did the evidence support the verdict, right? And here we've got a verdict of guilty, but it was based on an erroneous jury instruction. It wasn't a minor instruction mistake. It was a major mistake. The heart of this case was self-defense. And when you think about self-defense, essentially what a defendant is doing when he testifies is he says, I committed a crime or I committed this crime, but I had a legal justification to do so. And that's the reason why the self-defense instruction needs to be correct, because the defendant is essentially saying, I'm guilty. The elements of the offense have been completed. In this case, the defendant's testimony is either a completed first-degree assault or for a completed felony murder.
So, counsel, help me understand that argument a little more. You know, here, in this case, he testified, and yet the jury still found him guilty of second-degree intentional murder. So how would the correct jury instruction have, why is there a reasonable probability that the result would have been different given that he testified, you know, essentially on the along the lines of self-defense, but the jury still found him guilty of an intentional crime?
Well, two answers. The first is that the jury was looking at it in the context of the overall instruction. And in my view, the overall instruction in this case essentially gave the court's blessing, essentially, that this element had already been proved. It had already been proved that the murder was intentional because that's what the self-defense instruction said. And so if the jury...
Didn't the instruction say even if intentional?
It does say even if intentional, but when you read it in the context, that it's presupposing that it's intentional. It's essentially an emphasis, the way I read it. It's an emphasis saying even intentional, as in this case. It doesn't specifically say that, but I read even intentional to mean they're emphasizing that in this case it was intentional. And so the jury did find intentional, but as I said, they found it in the context, the overall context of this instruction. And when you're arguing self-defense, it's crucial that the instruction be correct, as I said, because you've admitted the elements of the offense, or at least you've admitted the conduct. And so if the issue here only is the intent, in my view, the way that this instruction as a whole were given is that you have to find intent, and his self-defense instruction has to be intentional. You can disbelieve his testimony because he said it wasn't intentional, and the court instruction is saying it was. And I think that's really the crux of it here, is that, you know, the self-defense instruction is not, you know, some tangential instruction, you know, that doesn't directly bear on the issue here. It's essentially similar to the instructions in, you know, of the charge, because the state has to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is similar to what they have to prove on the elements. And so I do believe that it makes a big difference. And again, if you look at that instruction, not only is it the intentional part, but it's also what my client's state of mind needs to be and what danger he's perceiving. In the general instruction, he just needs to be perceiving bodily harm. In the justifiable taking of a life, it's great bodily harm or imminent death. So the jury's looking at it, and then in that context, they don't get to analyze the self-defense argument that was made by counsel and that he testified to. So I think that's the difference, and that's why the analysis needs to be different in this case.
And if the proper instruction had been given, he would have need to have shown that his actions were reasonable in the circumstances, correct?
Correct. But the jury also would have been able to fairly and properly view whether it was this was intentional or not. And I think it's important to note what the charges here were. There was only one count. It wasn't, you know, there was a lesser count that the jury could have said, well, if it wasn't intentional, it's felony murder, it's first-degree assault. There was only one count, which was the intentional, which was intentional murder. And that's why the instruction here was so dangerous and so wrong, is because that's really where the rubber hit the road in this case. Was this murder intentional? And if so, was it justified? And that wasn't what my client said. My client said the murder wasn't intentional. And when the instruction requires the jury to do an analysis of whether it was intentional or not, and essentially says it was intentional, there is no self-defense claim, and my client essentially testified and convicted himself with his own testimony because he was not in a position, his lawyer wasn't in a position to make the proper argument in terms of what the state needed to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt, which wasn't whether he felt immediate great bodily harm, feared immediate great bodily harm or death, but whether he feared bodily harm and whether his actions were appropriate. Does that answer that question?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
And so the Pollard case, which the state tries to distinguish, doesn't make the distinction.
Counsel, I think the clock indicates that your time is up, but you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Lindsay Dreyer, certified student attorney supervised by Assistant Hennepin County Attorney John Schmidt on behalf of the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm because appellant has not demonstrated a reasonable probability that the outcome of this case would have been different but for the appellate counsel's error. First and most importantly, the appellant was convicted of intentional murder. For that reason, State v. Carradine is directly applicable and controlling authority. In Carradine, the court held that because the jury convicted the defendant of intentional murder, whatever ambiguity existed within the self-defense instruction regarding intent did not prejudice the defendant because the jury found that intent was satisfied and therefore rejected the defendant's testimony that he did not intend to kill. The same reasoning applies to this case. The jury convicted.
Didn't the same reasoning also apply in Pollard?
No, because in Pollard, the jury did not convict the defendant of intentional murder. So that is really, the two cases are in alignment with each other. They're not conflicting rulings. In Carradine, the court found that there is this implication that intent might be necessary in order for the self-defense to apply. But if the jury finds intentional murder, then whatever ambiguity regarding intent is within the self-defense instruction doesn't prejudice the defendant. In Pollard, on the other hand, the jury did not find that the defendant was guilty of intentional murder and instead found the defendant guilty of second-degree felony murder. And that is when the court focused specifically on this heightened fear of harm standard because the justifiable taking of life instruction requires that the defendant fear great bodily harm or death, and the general self-defense requires imminent danger of bodily harm.
Ms. Dreyer, Mr. Newmark distinguished the Carradine case based on the element of premeditation. Mm-hmm. Could you address that argument?
Sure. I think that if that's what the court... if the court found that to be a distinguishing factor in Carradine, the court would have mentioned it. I think in Carradine, really, it comes down to three factors that the court cared about. First, that the justifiable taking of life instruction was given in error. Second, that the defendant said he did not intend to kill. And third, that the jury convicted the defendant of intentional murder. The Carradine does not go into the specific facts of the case, whether or not premeditation was a factor that weighed in their analysis at all. Really, they just cared about those three factors I just mentioned. And so because that's all they really focused on in their reasoning, the same reasoning applies to this case. And then going back to Pollard, where there is this heightened fear of harm standard that they talked about, Pollard did not mention intent. Pollard did not say, nor Carradine say, that intent is somehow presupposed by this jury instruction. If anything, they said that there's this ambiguity regarding intent where jurors might think that intent is a necessary element, but not that jurors would assume that the defendant is conceding intent. And in Pollard, this was an issue because the jurors found that the defendant was not guilty of intentional murder. But then when they went back to analyze self-defense, they were still left with this heightened fear of harm standard within the instruction. And they found that perhaps the jury would have found that the defendant did fear imminent danger of bodily harm, but not great bodily harm or death. But in this case, that issue isn't present because under Minnesota law, it is appropriate to have this heightened fear of harm standard when a defendant does intend to kill. And in this case, the jury found that the defendant did intend to kill, so the heightened fear of harm standard was justified. Going back just to the jury instruction itself, so what Carradine said and what other courts have said, and that I mentioned before, is that the jury instruction creates this ambiguity regarding intent where jurors might think that intent is a necessary element of self-defense. But appellant's argument takes it one step further. He's really arguing that the instruction eliminated intent as it relates to the murder charge. And significantly, no court has held that, and appellant cites no cases where a court has supported that proposition. And a reading of the instruction refutes appellant's argument. The instruction stated that appellant's act must have been done in the belief that it was necessary. It doesn't follow that jurors would read that language and assume that the defendant was conceding intent. I think the only way that that argument would make sense is if the jurors had an advanced understanding of Minnesota criminal law and knew that this instruction was only given normally when a defendant would concede intent. But I think absent that circumstance, or if the judge had told the jurors this instruction is only given when a defendant concedes intent. But that didn't happen in this case, and so absent those circumstances, the language of the instruction does not imply that the defendant is conceding intent, and it doesn't state that the defendant is conceding intent. And again, no court has found that the instruction does that. If anything, they've found that the instruction adds this element of intent that then the jurors have to go back and look at, which again—
Apart from the language of the instruction regarding a concession around this issue, is there anything else that is evident from either what was in the record, in the trial record, or evident based on what this court previously concluded or determined about that record to suggest that there was no concession?
No, I think that because this issue hasn't been brought up, we're relying heavily on case law and what the case law says about this jury instruction.
Was it argued that this was not intentional?
Yes, yes.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. What in the trial record would indicate exactly that there was no concession?
Exactly.
I understand that we have an argument about the language of the instruction and what that language might have communicated, but it's not a vacuum. And we want to look at what else was argued to determine if that's a reasonable, if there was some influence on the jury's understanding based on the instruction.
Exactly. No, the judge and the prosecutor and the defense made very clear that intent was a disputed element of the crime, and that it was going to be up to the jurors to decide that element. And even, I think, appellant's brief refers to the instruction as the intentional justifiable taking of life instruction, but the actual instruction given to the jurors did not include the word intentional in the beginning. It just said justifiable taking of life instruction. So I do think that the court did what it could to minimize whatever reference there was to intent, I think because the instruction doesn't say that itself. And we did cite one case in our brief, State v. Mulaski, that did overturn a conviction based on this intent issue. But in that case, the judge told the jurors that they couldn't find that the defendant had, like, was acting in self-defense without intent to kill. And so that's where the court said that that was taking it, that the judge was essentially adding an element of intent, but also making it so that the jurors had to find intent in order for self-defense to apply. And that didn't happen in this case. It was just the instruction that was given. And in Carradine, the wording was different. It said that the killing must have been done in the belief that it was necessary. That is a stronger language than saying the defendant's act must have been done in the belief that it was necessary.
Can I ask a question then, too? Because I think there is a distinction that we've talked a lot about between the general and the justifiable taking of life instructions when it comes to the danger, the perceived danger. Is there also a difference when it comes to our analysis of the defendant's actions?
In what way?
In the two instructions. As I understand the general self-defense instruction, we not only analyze whether the perceived danger, whether that perception was reasonable, we also analyze whether the response was reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And we instruct juries that self-defense under the general instruction is limited to a reasonable use of force.
Mm-hmm.
So had the general instruction been given, that's what the jury would have been asked to analyze, not apart from the perception of danger, but mm-hmm. was this response a reasonable use of force? And I'm trying to compare that to the analogous portion of the instruction for justifiable taking of life,
mm-hmm.
and also at the same time layering on what this court previously determined the circumstances included, or what circumstances were already proved and what reasonable inferences may or may not have been there. So maybe you could address whether our previous determination of what circumstances had been proved, whether that determination has any impact on our analysis of prejudice when it comes to what a jury might have concluded on the reasonable response part of the two different instructions.
I think it could. I think because this court has already found that the response was not reasonable, that is sufficient evidence even with this erroneous instruction to uphold the conviction. I don't think you necessarily have to get into that. I think that Carradine is enough for you to just affirm based on that holding alone. I don't think you have to get into whether there's enough evidence to uphold or enough evidence that it would not have prejudiced the defendant. I think that that's like a secondary analysis that you could do, but I think that Carradine alone, and even Poehler, just in that Poehler doesn't support this case, but those holdings are enough for you to affirm on those grounds.
Mr. Newmark would likely argue that the justifiable taking of life, when you look at the response part of the equation, if you will, that you can't isolate that from the perception of danger, right? The instruction itself says, in light of danger,
mm-hmm.
and potential alternatives that are available, was that response reasonable?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that we could separate it? Or when we're looking at the response, you can only analyze that in light of the difference when it comes to fear or perception of danger?
Again, because Carradine didn't go into that and didn't find it to be necessary to go into that, so I don't think you need to. And, I mean, that argument also wasn't brought up in the briefs. Really, the argument focused specifically on this intent issue, which Carradine said is not applicable when the jury convicts the defendant of intentional murder. And I think the fact that the Court of Appeals, that you've already found that there was sufficient evidence to show that the defendant didn't act reasonably, that helps. But I think that the issue that courts have found with this jury instruction is the intent piece. And Carradine says that because the jury did find the defendant guilty of intentional murder, whatever implication of intent there was within the instruction didn't prejudice the defendant. And Carradine doesn't talk about any other differences that would have changed the outcome. And I think the fact that they didn't is a good indication that you don't need to get into that.
In appellant's brief, they argue this is at page 10, from the sequence of events present in this case, it's unclear whether the jury on its own rejected appellant's testimony or whether the erroneous instruction impacted the deliberations and verdict.
Mm-hmm.
Can you respond to that? And do you think Carradine answers that question, or what's
sure.
your view of that argument?
That's what I talked about before, where appellant sort of courts have identified an issue with this justifiable taking of life instruction, and appellant takes it one step further. Instead of arguing that there's ambiguity within the instruction regarding intent and jurors might believe they need to find intent to apply the instruction, appellant's arguing that the jurors just assumed intent was satisfied based on the language of the instruction, which no court has found or even hinted at that being a possibility. And then a reading of the instruction itself would not lead a juror to assume that intent was being conceded. Again, unless the judge or the prosecutor had told the jurors, this instruction is only given when a defendant concedes intent, I don't see how a jury would read, the defendant's act must have been done in the belief it was necessary, and assume that the defendant was conceding intent.
Well, and as I understand it, the other part of your argument is that if you look at the context of this trial as a whole, you couldn't possibly reach that conclusion either, where the argument was consistently made that the act was not intentional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is sort of our secondary argument, aside from just the jury instruction itself, that even if you found that there was more of an issue regarding intent within the instruction, the evidence still overwhelmingly supports the verdict. If there are no other questions, then I will rest on my brief. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes. To that last point, the evidence, if you believe the evidence is overwhelming, it's only because you have to assume the jury rejected appellant's testimony.
Mr. Neumeyer, could you go back one point?
Sure.
And address the, I guess there's two parts to it. Are you taking it one step further and saying it's not ambiguous? The instruction, the language of the instruction didn't create an ambiguity. It went further than that and essentially instructed them to find intent. Right? Is that what you're saying? And secondly, do you think that the context of the trial resolves that ambiguity?
There's a reason why there's two different instructions. There's a reason why there is, and the reason is because there's a danger that if you read the wrong instruction, if you read the justifiable taking of a life instruction, the jury's going to presuppose that it was intentional. And that's the danger in doing it, and that's why this court and the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, stop reading this instruction when the defendant says it wasn't intentional and when the defense argues it wasn't intentional. How many times are we going to be here on the wrong instruction and then just say, oh, well, there's no prejudice, and the courts can just continue to read the wrong instruction? The defendant's testimony is only incredible if the jury rejects it, and in this case, we can assume, or at least there's a reason to believe that it was rejected because of the instruction. And so getting to that last point, I don't think that the evidence is overwhelming. It's only overwhelming in the context of we believe the state's witnesses and disbelieve any evidence to the contrary, which is, again, a difference between this case and Carradine, because in Carradine, there were a number of witnesses who contradicted Carradine's version of events. In this case, there was no witness that contradicted appellant's version of events. It was circumstantial evidence, and in my view, it was the jury rejecting my client's testimony, essentially because the court said the justifiable taking of a life, which could only mean that he did it on purpose, he did it intentionally. So I think that's the concern there, and that's why, you know, you shouldn't take this in a vacuum. I agree with that, but a different context. You can't just look at the evidence and say, well, we're going to discount everything appellant said because the jury rejected it. We don't know whether the jury rejected it because they didn't believe
right,
it.
Right, but I guess there's another layer there that I was asking about. When it comes to whether there's ambiguity in what the jury is instructed or what the jury decides, we don't just look at a vacuum. We don't just look at the instructions alone. We look at the context of the trial, and I think the argument that is being made is, in the context of this trial, there's no confusion that intent was contested, not conceded, right? So do you agree that if there was ambiguity, that ambiguity could be resolved by looking at what happened in a trial? And then if you do, then argue about the facts of this case and why the arguments and the context of the trial doesn't help resolve whatever ambiguity might have been there.
In that case, you're assuming the jury's going to say, well, we're going to listen to the defendant, we're going to listen to the defense attorney, we're going to listen to the judge, and we're going to decide which one carries more weight. Of course they're going to listen to the judge. And they're told, even if you disagree with the law, this is the law. You need to follow my instructions. That's the problem here, is that you can't separate the two, and you can't ask the jury to say, well, on the one hand, we have the defendant saying it wasn't intentional. The other hand, we have, in closing argument, defense counsel saying it wasn't intentional. But then we have this instruction from the judge, which fairly can be read to say it was intentional. So which three is the jury going to take? They're going to take the side of the defendant and the defense counsel? They're going to take the side of the court? They're instructed that the arguments of counsel are not evidence. They're instructed to follow the instructions. And if you follow this instruction, you necessarily find the defendants guilty because the court essentially said this was an intentional murder. And, you know, for lawyers and judges to look at this and say, well, we can parse this out, that's asking a lot of jurors. Jurors are asked to follow the instructions, and we presume that they do. Are there any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.